You are listening to the Passion City Church podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times and locations, visit us online at passioncitychurch.com. Today's talk comes from the founder of Charity Water, Scott Harrison.
I'll start at the beginning. So I was born into a middle-class family in Philadelphia. This was my mom, my dad. When I was four, we moved into this drab gray house to get closer to my father's job. My parents had just become Christians, and he wanted to spend more time with me. They wanted to have a big family, and he wanted to reduce his commute, his driving time. Well, we didn't know when we moved into this house, in the dead of winter, this energy-efficient house, was that it had a carbon monoxide gas leak. This was before they had invented the detector that we can know, buy in blister packs at Home Depot. So we didn't know this. It was the dead of winter. My mom is fixing up the house. My dad and I was at school. He was at work. We were just sleeping in the house. And all of us start to get a little sick. And on New Year's Day, my mom passes out unconscious on my parents' bedroom floor. And after a series of blood tests, they identify the culprit, this mass amount of carboxyhemoglobin, carbon monoxide, in her bloodstream. And my mom didn't die, thankfully, but her immune system died, and she was never the same again. From that moment, she became allergic to the world. It's the best way of describing it. Anything chemical, anything toxic made her sick from this point on. Things that would just be normal for us, perfume or, the soap we might put on our hands or lotion or car fumes. All of these things made my mom terribly ill from this point. So I watched as a little boy my mom go from this vibrant mom. This was the heater actually that did it. My dad found it with a plumber friend. The gas company had come three times, said everything was completely fine, and he was the one that found the leak. Threw this mangled heater out on the curb. And I watched my mom go from a picture of health to a picture of sickness. She would wear these charcoal masks. She would walk around with oxygen tanks. And we had to prepare a containment room for her in our house, a safe room. And everything was washed with special soap. Her army cot that she slept on was washed in baking soda over 20 times. I remember there was aluminum foil covering the doors. And my mom was so sick that the print from books would give her these terrible reactions, the ink smell. So I remember as a kid, she still wanted to read, so I would bake her books in the oven, which was really fun as a kid because sometimes they would catch on fire and I thought we were gonna burn this stupid house down. And later, my dad would make me bake them outside in the sun. I just recently found a family photo where there were 50 books just laid out on the grass, trying to get that smell of print out. And I would take a baked or sun-baked book up to mom's room as a child, and I remember she would open the door, she'd have this mask on, and she would have these she'd have gloves on and a cellophane bag in her hands, and she would take the book for me with the cotton gloves because if she touched the print, it would get in her bloodstream. She'd put it inside the cellophane bag, and then with her mask on, she could read. So it was weird. It was just a weird childhood. My parents' family planning stopped, so they miscarried what would have been my sister and then stopped having kids with this illness. So I was thrust into a caregiver role at a really young age. And it was now up to me to cook for mom, to do the cleaning, to help out around the house. My parents had this deep faith. They decided not to sue the gas company for gross negligence. They probably could have gotten millions of dollars, but they didn't want to become bitter. They thought that God would make his purpose known through this terrible accident. So I grew up in the church. I grew up as that kid, with the bowl cut, playing piano every Sunday morning. Cute, thanks. It was an actual cereal bowl they used. And I did everything by the rules. I didn't swear. I didn't sleep around as I got a little older. I didn't cuss. I didn't drink. I was with the program. And then as I got a little older, 18 happened. And, I had this moment of just rebellion. I said, look, I've lived my whole life playing by the rules, taking care of mom. Now it's my turn. I want to have some fun. And, I really believe that those rules were there to prevent me from living my best life. prevent me from experiencing the world. So I say, I'm gonna move to New York City. I join a rock band. I put my hair down to my shoulders, which was a terrible idea. And the band breaks up immediately. No surprise there, because we all hated each other. But now I'm living in New York City, and I come across an occupation that if one wanted to rebel, you could rebel in style as a nightclub promoter. And there is an actual job in New York City where you can get paid to drink alcohol in public. You can professionally drink. All you need to do is get the right people inside the right clubs. And if you do that, you could charge them ridiculous amounts for a drink. I mean, we would sell a vodka soda for $22. People spend $600 on a bottle of champagne that costs $30 just to be around the right people. So I start working in these clubs at 19, 2 years before I'm even allowed in the clubs legally. And I'm climbing up New York City social ladder. I want to be the king of New York. I want to be the number one promoter in all of New York City. Over the next 10 years, I work at 40 different nightclubs. This is a picture taken of me in a VIP room, about 28. And what's so sad about this picture is the most important thing to me at the time is showing a nightclub photographer I have never met that I own an expensive watch. I'm trying to flash my Rolex at this guy. This is my business partner, Brantley. We were so successful at the time, we were getting paid $4,000 a month by Budweiser just to be seen drinking Bud in public. And Bacardi paid us another $4,000 a month to have that bottle on our table. So we're like, this is amazing. I mean, what better of a life could you hope for? So this is around, I don't know, 10, midnight. This would be around 3 in the morning when the decline begins. And this might be around noon the next day. So after 10 years, I picked up every vice that you might imagine would go with the territory. I've smoked 2 packs of Marlboro Reds every day for 10 years. I have a serious drinking problem. I have a serious drug problem. You name it, cocaine, ecstasy, heroin, MDMA, Special K, pretty much everything short of heroin. I've got a gambling problem. I have a pornography problem. I have a strip club problem. But my life, here, I won't make you look at this anymore. My life on the outside looks great. I'm flying around to Fashion Week. I drive a BMW. I've got the stupid watch. I've got the model girlfriend who's on the cover of fashion magazines. I have a grand piano in my New York City apartment. But I was rotting inside, literally rotting. My parents, for 10 years, have been praying their prodigal home. I mean, nothing worked. I remember once my father signs me up on an email list for a group called Models for Christ, thinking that maybe a Christian model might bring me back into the fold. They have, you know, ladies in prayer closets at their church just wearing holes in the carpets with their knees. You know, nothing is working for 10 years. Their only son has gone rogue. 10 years in, I go home for Christmas, and I used to just flaunt my lifestyle and rub it in my parents' face. I was a bad son. And my dad gives me this book to take on vacation to South America, to Uruguay, called The Pursuit of God by A.W. Tozer. And I'm like, oh, sure, Dad, I'll throw it in my bag. So I go on this trip, and it was amazing. We rented a compound with servants waiting on us and horses. And I remember spending $1,000 on fireworks. They were magnums of Dom Perignon, what we'd all been waiting for. And I was partying like crazy at night, and then during the day, I start reading deep theology, like A.W. Tozer, and with a hangover. And there was something, I think, so opposite. I felt like I was reading the most sharp contrast to my life. This was about pursuing God, about pursuing virtue, about pursuing purity, selflessness to others. And something in me awakened. You know, I'm sensitive to the church words, you know, convicted, but that's probably the best way to describe it. I wanted to come home. And I realized not only was I emotionally bankrupt, not only was I spiritually bankrupt, I was morally bankrupt. I mean, I came across this verse in James that says, true religion is to look after widows and orphans in their distress. Okay, and then to live, keep yourself from being polluted by the world. I'm like, I am 0-2. Officially 0-2. Not only am I perhaps the most polluted person I know, I actually pollute others for a job. Like, the more people get wasted at our clubs, the more money I would make. So I start praying again. I come back to New York City and go on about a six-month journey where I'm trying to find a way out. And 6 months later, there's an event at a nightclub that involves guns and a whole scene. And I have this moment where I say, I'm going to get out of town. I rent a cobalt blue Ford Mustang. I remember grabbing a bottle of Dewars and a Bible, carton of Marlboro Reds, and I just start driving north, like north. I have no idea where I'm going to end up. And I'm praying and smoking and drinking and praying and reading the Bible. Like, there's just this conflict going on for my old lifestyle and where I want to go. And I wind up in Maine, a dial-up internet cafe in Moosehead Lake. And I ask myself this question. I say, what would the exact opposite of my life look like? Not a little turn, 25 or 45 or 90 degrees. What would a 180 degree opposite look like? And I feel like I hear, well, that would look like serving God and serving others, or serving the poor. So I come up with this idea that I am going to never go back to New York City. I'm going to sell almost everything I own. And I'm going to give one year as a tithe for the 10 that I'd selfishly wasted. And I'm going to serve God and I'm going to serve others. So from this dial-up cafe in Maine, I start applying to all the famous humanitarian organizations I'd peripherally heard of over the years. I put in applications for World Vision and Samaritan's Purse and Save the Children and the Red Cross and UNICEF. Scott Harrison, the great nightclub promoter, is ready for service. So you can guess what happens next. No one will take me. I'm denied by every organization. They won't even take me for free. So I've actually liquidated my life. I put up 2,000 DVDs on eBay in a single lot, just trying to purge everything and start over. And no one will take me. So one organization finally writes me back and says, hey, if you're willing to pay us $500 a month, and if you're willing to go live in a country called Liberia, that's just come out of a 14-year civil war, I'd never even heard of this country. Like, you can volunteer with us. I'm like, yes, I'm in. Here are my credit card details. When does it start? They said 3 weeks. I said, this is perfect. What's more opposite than having to pay and actually going to the poorest country in the world? It had fallen off the United Nations development chart. It was ranked dead last. So I dust off a journalism degree that I'd gotten and never used at NYU, and I say, look, let me come on and be your volunteer photojournalist. I can take pictures. I can tell stories. And by the way, I've developed a nightclub list of 15,000 people. I have all their emails. I've been getting them drunk for 10 years. Maybe I could tell them a different story. Maybe they would actually care. So this organization takes me on. I land in Liberia following 14,000 peacekeepers. And I join this amazing mission. This is going to be my new home, a 522-foot hospital ship. It was an ocean liner that had been converted, gutted, and turned into a state-of-the-art hospital with 42 beds. And it was a very simple idea behind this mission: bring the very best doctors and surgeons on their vacation time to offer free medical care to people who can't afford it in countries where there often was no access to medical care. So I'm living down in about 125 square foot cabin down by the waterline with two roommates, immediately feeling sorry for myself because the conditions were so poor. The ship was 50 years old. There were cockroaches everywhere. Then I get off the ship and I see how people are living. But I meet this guy named Gary Parker, and he becomes my first mentor, my first guide. And I get to know a little bit about his story. He's the chief medical officer. Learn that, not so similar to me, he had signed up for a period of time. He'd signed up for 3 months. He was a surgeon in California. He said, maybe I could do 3 months and I could operate on others. When I got on the ship, he had been there 21 years. He never went back to his practice. Met his wife, raised his kids on the ship. He'd been there 21 years using his skill in the service of others. So I have this all-in moment. I realize that for my life to change, for me to be able to start over or turn the page or get this clean slate, I'm going to have to just quit it all. So I'm not gonna lie, I went out with a bang. Night before I walked up the gangway, I smoked 3 packs of Marlboro Reds, drank like 8 beers. I actually turned up embarrassingly with a hangover the next day, reporting for duty. But I knew that was it. I knew that that had to be it. There was something prophetic, symbolic about walking up on a ship, the gangway being pulled in, and then sailing away to a new continent and to my new life, where I could just leave all of that dead stuff on the shore, on land. So I do, and I never smoke again, I never gamble again, I haven't looked at a pornographic image in 15 years, I don't have sex for 5.5 years until my wedding night. Okay, let me tell you, I was like a playboy in New York City. I'm like, I'm gonna sign up for it, I'm gonna sign up for all of it, to allow this new story to happen in my life. So I find Liberia to be a disaster, guys. It's no electricity, no running water, no sewage. People living in bombed out buildings like this, in houses that were once beautiful, completely decimated by the war. There's one doctor in Liberia for every 50,000 citizens. Here we have a doctor for every 300 Americans. So if you get sick, you're out of luck. 2 surgeons in a country of millions, nowhere to operate. So that's what we were there to do. Before the ship was pulled into the port, a small advance team flyered the country saying, hey, if you have a giant facial tumor, if you have flesh-eating disease, never even heard of that, if you were born with a cleft lip or a cleft palate, if you've been burned during the war, often the rebels would pour oil over the children trying to fuse their body parts together for fun. Turn up and maybe we can reconstruct your body. My third day in Africa, my third day on this mission, never forget it. I wake up in the morning, it's still dark. I grab my 2 Nikon cameras. I put on hospital scrubs. Around 5:15 in the morning, I jump in a convoy of Land Rovers with medical staff. And we snake through the city, and our final destination is a football stadium, a soccer stadium that the government has given us to triage the patients. And I know that we have 1,500 available surgery slots. I'm like, is it possible that 1,500 people are sick with these conditions? We turn the corner, there are 5,000 people standing in the parking lot waiting to get in. And this was a moment I remember weeping, realizing, oh my gosh, we're gonna send over 3,000 people home with no hope. I later learned many of these people had walked more than a month just hoping to see a doctor that might be able to help them. First person I photographed, the first kid in line, was this little boy named Alfred Sassou. He was 14, suffocating to death on his face with a very benign tumor. Now his mom says to a translator, 4 years ago, my son was completely fine. This is what he looked like, Alfred at 10. And then something started growing on his face and there was no surgeon to take him to, so they took him to the local witch doctors and they cut him with knives and with sticks. They spread pastes, they chanted. None of this worked. Tumor just grew larger and larger. 4 years later, boy could hardly breathe, could hardly eat. And I realized we were there to help. We were there to transform lives like Alfred's. A couple days later, I scrubbed up. I watched these amazing surgeons on their vacation time remove the tumor, throw it into the medical waste. I got to take him home a week later with his new face, and I got to watch Alfred heal. It was an amazing transformation. This was my job was like. I would wake up in the morning and I would photograph the patients scheduled that day. Martha Lean told me this tumor had grown for 8 years. You can see she holds a towel at the bottom of the frame. She would say, I have to cover my face in public because if people see my tumor, they stone me. They would throw rocks at her face. They thought she was spiritually cursed. They thought she had done something in the spirit world to bring this terrible affliction on herself. What she needed was a surgeon and about 40 minutes under the knife just to remove a benign mass, get her face and her life back. So this first year, I take 50,000 photos. I could spend hours telling you about all the amazing people that I met, these people of courage, many who had walked from 2 or 3 countries away just to hope to see a doctor. Now, my club list is also getting the privilege of these photos. You can imagine how that went. Definitely a few unsubscribes, right? I signed up for the Prada party, not the tumor or leprosy party. But that was the edge case, actually. Most people said, how do I help? How do I give my time? How do I join the ship? How do I give my money? And I realized my work wasn't done. I did an exhibition in New York, raised about $100,000 with these photos, asking people to give at the end of the exhibition. And I went back for a second year to Liberia. And on that second tour, I got off the ship, out of the towns, and I spent time in the rural areas. And I learned what was making so many people sick. I saw dirty water for the first time. And I learned that 50% of the country was drinking dirty, contaminated water. They were drinking from swamps like this, green swamps, brown rivers. Met this teenage girl named Hawa, realized this is the only water she'd known her entire life, all she'd ever known. And I'm taking these photos back and showing them to the doctors in the operating theater. I'm like, do you see what people are drinking? No wonder they're standing in parking lots outside stadiums. And the doctors are like, yeah, we know. There's tons of data on this. In fact, 52% of all the disease throughout the developing world is caused by unsafe water, lack of sanitation and hygiene. So Dr. Gary says, why don't you go make this your issue? Rather than help us raise money for another $50 or $60 million ship, why don't you go work on the root cause of some of the sickness? I'm like, well, maybe I will. So I come back to New York, and there was such a responsibility to do something about what I'd seen. I said, okay, I'm gonna try and go on a mission to help everybody get clean water. My friends are still drinking $10 bottles in nightclubs. They would order water, not even open it. There was no awareness about this issue. I said, well, maybe I can help break through to some of them. So the mission was very clear. Coming back, I'm gonna help bring clean water to every single person on earth. This is the scale, the size of the problem. Today, 663 million human beings, simply because of where they were born, simply because of the conditions they arrived in that they did not choose. 1 in 10 people on the planet are drinking bad water. Today, 663 million. Now, I put up a number like this and we just kind of numb out. It's impossible to connect to statistics this big, to numbers this big. So over the last decade, we have tried to tell stories of the people that are trapped inside this huge number. Kids like John Bosco in southern Rwanda. John Bosco has never known anything except this swamp. This is the water that he has grown up with. Water for drinking, water for cooking, water for cleaning. It's all he's ever known. Photograph this little girl in Honduras. She was drinking from a river. It looked more like chocolate milk. You know, we look at this water and say, we would never drink this water. We would never give this water to our children. We wouldn't give this water to our animals, not our dogs. But yet it's what we were seeing people drink. I learned about all the diseases associated with bad water. Everyone in this room has heard of cholera. It can kill you within a day. E. coli, you've heard of. I had not heard of schistosoma before, which I found out was just a fancy word for parasites or worms. Learned that over 200 million people had worms crawling around in their body because of the water they'd been forced to drink. This is what that looks like. This little girl in Kenya was drinking from the Molo River, a brown river, and every time she would drink from this bottle, she would vomit on her shirt. And we watched this in horror for a few cycles, and we took the water away from her and promised to try to find a sustainable solution. But I wanted to know what was in this water. Took this bottle back to New York City. I gave it to a lab. This is what they sent me. The technician said, you sent us water that is alive. No human, certainly no child, should be drinking this. I learned that leeches were a huge problem as people got their drinking water. In a million years, I had never associated leeches with water. Community after community, they would say, look, these big leeches, we always get them out, but sometimes these little leeches, they can get through the cloth that we filter our water through and they can grow up inside our bodies or worse, the bodies of our children. And the leeches like to crawl up to the back of the throat. We would hear stories of parents giving their children diesel fuel to drink, to scald the leech. The other alternative was a stick. You can mash the leech, but if you don't actually kill it, it just crawls up again. That's how most of the women filter the water. They pour it through scarves, through shirts. They often don't have the money to buy the charcoal to boil it, or there's just no awareness. I learned that water impacted education and that one out of every three schools throughout the world not only didn't have clean water, didn't have toilets. Imagine sending your child to a school. Imagine attending a school with no clean water, no toilets. And we realized this was a huge problem for girls. This is why teenage girls were dropping out. They would stay home 1 week every month. You're not gonna go to a school with no sanitation, no water. They would fall behind in their studies. And there's already so much enormous social pressure against these girls being educated in so many of these cultures. It would break our heart to see them in the middle of the school day walking 5-6 hours carrying 40 pounds of dirty water on their backs in these yellow fuel cans. The last thing I'll say about the problem is it's a women's issue. I've been to 69 countries now. I've never seen men get water. Culturally, whether I'm in Central or South America or Sub-Saharan Africa or India or Southeast Asia, it is the role of the women and the girls to find the water. And we see women in the most undignified situations. These women trying to get to the eye of a spring. The black spots, that's cow feces. They've got their kids on their back, ankle deep in muck, trying to get water before it's completely contaminated. This woman I met in Eastern Kenya, she was just digging in the sand, a sandy riverbed, trying to find water. I asked her what the alternative is. She sent me to a river nearby. At the river, they said the biggest problem here is actually not the quality of the water, it's crocodile attacks. Start naming women who came here and were never seen again, hauled off by crocodiles. Now you hear this, you know, the first time you think, oh, maybe it's just a shocking story. Here it's 70 times, 120 times. You realize this is a real problem. So the good news is that it's actually a completely solvable problem. We actually know how to bring clean water to every single human being on earth. I have friends that are working on more complex issues. They are looking for disease, the cures to diseases in labs or in test tubes. They're trying to develop vaccines that we may or may not be able to. Water is just not like that. There isn't a single person alive on the planet where we're scratching our heads saying, oh, we have no idea how we would ever be able to get them clean water. We haven't created the will to do it. We haven't created the awareness. We haven't created the energy or the movement to do this yet, but we know how to do it. And there's no silver bullet. There's no one-size-fits-all solution, but a lot of different things work in a lot of different contexts. You can dig wells. You can drill wells. You can build rainwater harvesting systems, spring protections, biosand filters, pond sand filters, sometimes high-tech stuff, UV, carbon, UF. It's often as simple as finding the clean water beneath these villages and drilling a well for about $10,000. It's a terrible irony when you go in and you watch people dying on top of the resource that could save their lives. But what they don't have access to is about $1 million of drilling equipment, compressors and trucks and rigs, or skilled hydrologists to know how to find the water. And when you're able to bring those into a village and find water, it's one of the most amazing things to be a part of, to actually see in that moment, people see clean water for the first time in their life. There was a story from Ethiopia. Our partners here had been drilling a well, and normally it's this raucous celebration. Thousands of people surround the rig. There's clapping, there's screaming, there's dancing. In one of these villages, there was a woman off to the side, and she was weeping, an older woman. Our partner walks up to her and says, hey, like, did you not get the memo? This is a happy day. Why are you crying? And she says with this like angry look on her face, she says, do you mean to tell me that my entire life I walked hours for water to that dirty river, and it was underneath my feet the whole time? Stories under the ground. This was a village in Malawi. They actually built the road over 3 months to allow the drilling rig. I'm going to play a clip in a moment. There was a huge ravine. It was cut off, and they said, well, we'll fix that. We will build a road. Every single family member or every household sent one person for 3 months, and they just built this road, and they filled it in, and they filled it in. This was that moment when they got clean water. I'll play just a short clip. Just imagine for a second, put yourself in that moment. Imagine you and your family and your children, you have never had it before in your life. And then one day a rig comes in and makes it look easy. In 48 hours, just finds water. So I've been a part of those so many times, those celebrations. Yeah, that never gets old. That never, ever, ever gets old. We believe water changes everything. We have said this for years. We believe water is the most transformative thing on the planet. It brings health into communities, into the lives of children. It brings better education. If schools have clean water and toilets, you get better students. It gives time back to women who use that extra time not walking for water anymore, to start small businesses, selling rice at the market, selling peanuts. I was recently in Zimbabwe and Zambia with women who were selling rugs for $4. Many women tell us we're better moms. We get to spend more time with our families, with our children, teaching and leading our families. This woman, Helen, told us that when she got clean water for the first time in her life, she felt beautiful because she finally had enough water to wash her face and her body. She said, I was making sacrifices. I always put my family first. I let them use all the water. I washed my kids' school uniforms and my husband's clothes and his body, and I cooked for them, and I let them drink it. Water brings dignity back to people. And probably the greatest thing about working on this issue is that it's one of the very few things that everybody can agree on. We can all agree that people should have clean water to drink. And regardless if you're a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican or an independent or a Christian or a Jew or a Mormon or a Muslim or an atheist, every single person can agree on this. You know, I never finish a talk and have people tell me, you got to stop that. This, let them die of bad water. Let those women walk for 5 hours. Right? Nobody wants kids to drink from swamps. So it's been an unbelievably unifying thing. It's brought people together that might fight about just about every other thing, but say, you know what, we could do this. Okay, I'll talk a little bit about the organization. So I'll rewind. I come back from Mercy Ships. I'm back in New York City. I'm on fire with this mission, bring clean water to everybody on the planet. But I got no money, because nightclub promoters are not good at saving money. And I gave everything I had to Mercy Ships and the people I met along the way. So I start Charity Water anyway. My nightclub partner takes me in and says, hey, you can use my couch as your first office. He let me sleep on the closet floor, walk-in closet floor next to this room in Soho, New York. But I was on a mission. Like, I'm going to bring clean water to every single person on earth. I could see it very clearly. The day when everyone had this most basic resource. So I start talking to my friends. I'm running around with my laptop showing those photos to people in DJ booths and nightclubs because those are the people I knew. I'm getting kicked out of DJ booths. They're like, you are killing my buzz. Like, you got to stop this. Can't show pictures of dirty water and tumors in nightclubs, okay? But I was trying to invite people into this. As I talk to everyday people, I realized this is not going to be easy. There's a problem because my friends, and then I learned everyday people, they don't trust charities. People had all these objections for why they were not giving. I learned there was data behind this. 42% of Americans polled by USA Today actually said, we don't trust charities. 70% of people polled by NYU here in the country said, we believe charities either waste our money or badly waste our money. So I thought, this is an opportunity. I don't want to steal other charities' loyal donors. Let's reach out to the people who aren't giving. Let's speak to their objections. So the real vision was even bigger than the mission to bring people clean water. The vision became to reinvent or reimagine charity. I love the word charity. It's Latin. It's caritas in the Latin. It means to help your neighbor in need and get nothing in return. Thought we need more of this. We need more love in the world, more charity in the world, not more people cynical about this. So this would really be the mission, to start a movement of generosity and compassion and take disenchanted, cynical, skeptical people and bring them back to the table and say, look, we're gonna do something different, have another look. So I had three big ideas, really, that I thought would speak to some of the objections. The first was we had to deal with the money problem. Could we create a way where 100% of every donation Charity Water ever took would go directly to help people get clean water? Now, imagine me telling you this 10 years ago. People are like, that's the stupidest idea I ever heard. How would you pay yourself, your staff, your office someday? I was like, I don't know. But I'm gonna open up a separate bank account. And in that separate bank account, we will raise all the overhead from a very small group of people. We are gonna make overhead cool somehow. Make it cool to pay for the office and the toner for the Epson copier. But 100% of every dollar, $100, $1 million we receive from the public will go directly to projects. So what's people's next excuse? Well, the next one was that I don't see impact. I said, great, we're gonna prove every single water point we ever fund anywhere in the world. This was made possible with technology. Charity Water and Google Earth started the same year. We realized Google was giving us a free place where we could geolocate every water point. We could build the most hyper-transparent charity the world had ever seen using the available technology. We would never spend a dollar unless we could prove it. Third thing was, we believed for this work to be culturally appropriate and sustainable, it had to be led by the locals. No one like me, with my skin color, should be running around Central and South America or Africa or Asia drilling wells. Our role could be to get people to care, to raise funds as efficiently as possible. But the work had to be led by the locals in these countries. People in Ethiopia leading their communities, their families, their countries forward. They would be the ones getting the credit. Their hydrologists, their technicians, their drivers, their construction crews. So this sounds so simple, but no one was doing anything like this 10 years ago. So we put these together, and the only thing I could think of to get this thing started was to throw a birthday party for myself in a nightclub. Day one. So I got 700 people to come. I gave them open bar for an hour. And on their way in, I said, you got to drop $20 as a donation in this big plexi box. I remember that night, a drug dealer came and he gave $500. He sold marijuana. And he said, this is the first charitable gift I have ever made in my life. But I know where the money's going. I trust this thing. That night, we raised, that was not our demographic, by the way, but the winning trust was cool. That night, we took the $15,000 we collected. We took every penny to a refugee camp in northern Uganda where 31,638 people were living. They were drinking out of this swamp. We did our first few projects, and then we sent the proof, the photos, the GPS, video of clean water flowing back to the 700 people that came and said, you did this. This is where your $20 went. People were blown away to ever hear from us again. They never expected to hear from a charity. They went to a party at a nightclub, they gave $20. They said, how can we give more? We said, there's something here. Let's create this virtuous cycle of giving. Let's restore people's faith in charity, in giving. And maybe this thing can really, really grow. We just tried to be creative. We shot rich people in New York City in the same situations as the people we were seeing around the world. Imagine if your mom had to drink water with bone and hair in it as it came down from a slum. Imagine if your children going to a private school in their uniforms had to carry water on their backs. Imagine if my banker friends had to go to Central Park Pond in the middle of the day in their fancy suits. We would never allow this. But it was okay for a tenth of the world. It was okay for other people's children because of where they were born. We shot campaigns to just try to get people to think differently about water and have some fun every once in a while. You know, imagine Kool-Aid without water. My kids would probably like this. A lot of the times we were serious. Imagine if your mom giving your kids death in a baby bottle every day, playing Russian roulette with their lives because you have no choice. I believed if we had creative, compelling, excellent content, we would get donated media. And that turned out to be true. We got buses donated. We got taxi tops donated. $1 million TV slots donated. As people just wanted to spread this message. We tried to just bring the materials we were buying to life. We wound up shooting a bunch of stuff using drones. We said, look, someone gives $10,000 to build a well. Where does it go? Well, these are the materials that it buys. That's the rig. This is the team. These are all the materials that go into one biosand filter project in Cambodia, one village, just trying to bridge connection. The money does this, helps these people. We built a digital-only charity, only because direct mail just seems stupid to us and not the future. Thought that I would buy your physical mailing address and send you paper that you don't want and then ask you to write a check. That was not the future. I invited myself to speak at Twitter headquarters when there were 28 employees at the company. We just realized this was how the movements of the future would be built, and we always tried to find ways to celebrate our community. The amazing things they were doing, bringing their creativity and their passion to this issue. We partnered with luxury retailers. This was a fun one. We went to Saks Fifth Avenue and we're like, you sell $5,000 purses. We have some $5,000 water projects. We should totally be working together because we're both in New York City. I think they'd never heard anything quite so insane. So they wind up shooting two catalogs in water. They give us the windows of New York City, Beverly Hills, Chicago. They let us build wells in the store. We build wells in Saks. They raised $700,000 in the first campaign, just getting their community involved. Partner with American Express, they put us on their homepage, start taking huge campaigns out in print, trying to raise awareness about the water crisis and the needs out there. We wind up opening the NASDAQ 3 times. We become the go-to charity when a company who's about to go public doesn't make it at the last minute. They call us at 8 o'clock at night and we're like, we will open up the NASDAQ. We'll take that awareness. Same thing with the New York Times. We've done this 4 times now. Or the New York Stock Exchange. Just looking for new ways to tell the story, new ways to get the brand out there and get people aware and engaged with this. We stumbled upon this idea on our second anniversary. I didn't want to go back to the club and throw another party. And I thought, I certainly don't need a birthday party. I don't need gifts. I have everything I need. What if I could donate my birthday and turn it into a redemptive giving moment that involved my friend and family and community? So I said, I thought the sticky idea would be I'd ask for $32 for my 32nd birthday. So I email every single person I know, will you give $32 for my 32nd birthday? 100% of the money goes and you'll get to see exactly where it goes. To my surprise, this spreads beyond my community. I raised $59,000. 7-year-old kid, Austin, Texas, Max Schmidhauser, donates his birthday. He starts knocking on doors in Austin, raises over $22,000. Now, I'm not gonna lie, he lived in a very nice neighborhood, okay? These were nice doors. There were some 77s and some 777s. Tony Hawk donates his birthday. Jack Dorsey donates 3 birthdays, who created Twitter and Square. Will and Jada Smith approaches. They donate their birthdays. They then ask their fans to donate their birthdays. They then say, can we come with you to see the impact we made? They come with me to Ethiopia for a week to see where the money from their birthdays had gone and report back to their community. So all that was cool, but I swear to you, the heart of the community was 6-year-olds in New York City that were neither rich nor famous, 16-year-olds in the middle of the country like Maggie Moran, one of my favorites, 89-year-old Nona Ween. She writes this beautiful thing on her website. She says, I'm turning 89 and I'd like to make that possible for more people. She realizes she's lived twice as long as so many of the people in the countries where we're working because of the privilege she was born into. And if her birthday could help people have more birthdays, that's what she wanted for her 89th. Some people are like, I gotta do something now. I can't wait. My birthday's 10 months from now. So they start climbing mountains for charity water. They start skydiving for charity water, making sails and sailing across the Atlantic Ocean. This guy takes the $10,000 he saved for a wedding ring, donates a well instead, proposes to his wife, saying, I want to start our marriage off with an act of radical generosity back in our homeland. Jesse from Atlanta listens to Nickelback for 168 consecutive hours. He's rewarded for his pain with $36,000 in donations. Cosette, at 4 years old, sells over $5,100 painting for charity water. Maddie in Vancouver does 12 lemonade stands, one of them in the rain, undeterred by the rain. Her mom's like, you are not selling lemonade in the rain, Maddie. She's like, I will sell lemonade in the rain. Her 12th and final lemonade stand, she convinces a local band to perform on the sidewalk. to attract buyers. She sells over $5,000 of lemonade. So this community begins to just grow around the world, and we realize very early on, this is not our story, this is their story. This is a much bigger story here. We are not the hero, we're the guide in this story. We start celebrating the Maggies and the Rachels and the Nonas and say, look at them, look at people bringing the best of themselves, rejecting apathy, right? That could be so easy to embrace with a paralyzing issue like this. And making a huge difference. We start focusing on radical transparency, putting trackers on our drilling rigs and giving them Twitter accounts. So our drilling rigs now tweet their location so people can track them. As we scaled across the country, we started building sensors thanks to a grant from Google and retrofitting our wells, putting our wells online so we would know that they were continuing to work over time and how much water was flowing. And now we can pick out wells with sensors and not only see the satellite images, not know that they were working when we left, but 5 years later, last week, exactly how much water was flowing every single day, taking transparency just to a new level. A lot of this has worked. In 12 years, now over 1 million people from 105 countries have joined us. They have given over a third of $1 billion, $330 million. It's allowed us to bring clean water to 29,000 villages for 8.4 million people. And I'm so proud of the... I'm so proud of the locals. Right now, we employ 650 locals out there who are... They're the heroes. They are showing up every day, taking this money, drilling wells, building these various systems. This guy, he is still there. 35 years later, he's still on the ship. He has taught me so much about this long obedience in the same direction, showing up, using the best of what God has given him, his hands, for 3.5 decades, not for profit, not for personal gain, living in a tiny cabin on the ship, but helping others day in and day out. I recently got to see the first well for my birthday. It's not pretty, but 12 years later, my 31st birthday well was still pumping water in that camp in Uganda. We reckon that pump has been, that handle has been up and down over 50 million times, produced over 12 million liters. It's 24 million little bottles of water. And John Bosco, I told you about him at the very beginning. Well, he was one of the first people we helped, and we got to take him and his family from this disgusting swamp, from unthinkable water and suffering. And because everyday people cared, they stretched their hands out across an ocean, not because they had to, because they wanted to, and provided the resources for that well to be built. Then drilling rigs start moving towards this village, and they pull off the paved roads into the rural areas. John Bosco watches local Rwandans. Imagine, they must have been heroes. They start looking for water underneath the village. A couple days later, they find it, and they start building the well. And in less than a week, he's drinking clean water for the very first time in his life. Now, this was one of our first. We've gotten to visit him over the years. 8 years later, we went back, and our cute and a preteen kid, he was all grown up. He was a man. And in that time, he started his own family. He got married and he had his own daughter, Jean-Marie. And we realized that she never had to drink from the swamp. Literally, the cycle of water poverty had been broken 8 years ago because people cared. They did something about it. Her legacy will be different. She doesn't need to be the statistic under that baby bottle of 4,500 kids dying every day of preventable disease like diarrhea. And that's what keeps us going, knowing we've been able to do that in 29,000 villages. As we look ahead, we're really trying to encourage ourselves, always 8.4 million people. It's a volume of people. I was at Madison Square Garden recently in New York City with my wife and I looked around and I'm like, honey, it's over 420 stadiums. Madison Square Garden's full of people. It would fill up your biggest stadium, Mercedes-Benz, 118 times. So 118 times full and then empty and full and empty. It's a lot of people. But put it against the problem, and we've done very little. We're at the very beginning of this journey. It's 1/78th of the work that needs to be done to end this. 1/78th, 1.3%. So we just need to go faster and help more people. This year, we're helping 4,000 new people every single day get clean water. Last year, that number was 3,000 people a day. Today, 4,000 people, it's twice the amount of the capacity of this room. Two times this room, they got clean water today for the first time in their lives. They're gonna get clean water tomorrow and then the next day. That's our KPI. That is our number one thing we are trying to move up and up. If you're sitting there and you're wondering how you might help or how you might join, first, I wanna just commend you guys in your community for what you have done with this movement. We have been watching from New York. We have been fans watching it done with excellence, watching people take a very difficult issue and bring it to the spotlight. It's such an important cause that so many of you in this room have embraced. If you were interested in working with us in our cause, there are really two ways to help. The first is pretty simple. It's actually buying a book. I spent the last 2 years going through this terrible writing process of trying to get all the stories down and a lot of the stuff I couldn't talk about today. And I put it out into the world about a month ago. It's called Thirst. I donated the whole book advance, all the proceeds. I won't make any money from this. I wanted the book to tell the stories that might move people and help more people get clean water. Launched it a month ago, and it was amazing. We didn't really know what was going to happen. On launch day, the first morning, I wake up, and I find that Bill Gates has been tweeting about the book. Over 50 million people telling people they should go buy it and read it. And then Mike Bloomberg and Richard Branson and Arianna Huffington and all these amazing people get behind this project. It debuts on the New York Times bestseller list in a really amazing political time. And it debuts at number 2 on the LA Times list. And the book is just starting to spread these stories out there. So one easy way to help. There's a donor that read it that was so inspired that says, I'll pay $30 from anybody who buys the book and just sends you in a receipt. I'll give one person clean water on their behalf. So it's an easy way to help if you, I think we sold out of them this morning, but you could grab it on Amazon, just forward your receipt and someone will get clean water, just as simple as that. And then do share it, the story with someone else. The second way to help is a new community called The Spring. And as we turned 10, we said, we've done a lot, we wanna do a lot more. Could we create a community of people who wouldn't show up just once, who wouldn't just donate one birthday, but would show up month in, month out? Maybe in the same way they do for HBO or for Netflix or for Spotify or Apple Music, for some of their content. Could we create a subscription program for pure good where 100% of the value was passed on to people who needed clean water? Where you would get nothing in return. So we called it The Spring, like the word. It's a time of new beginnings. It's also literally where so much of the clean water on earth comes from. And we started to ask people to join. We said, look, it costs us $30 to give one person clean water. We know there's a lot of people that could probably do that every month. A lot of students and college kids could do less, maybe 10 bucks. Some people might be able to do even more with their small business. But it would really be people showing up to make this a part of their story, to make this a part of their legacy as we continue to grow and help more people and get smarter and grow the capacity of our locals around the world. Started to spread as we started showing stories of impact back to people, spread to 104 countries around the world now. And I was pulling the data on the plane yesterday, and the coolest thing is that Atlanta is one of the biggest cities of Spring members ever. We have over 1,000 people here. Over 3% of the entire community globally is here in Atlanta for the Spring. So it's an easy way to help. You could go to charitywater.org/Atlanta. You're all invited to join me. I'm a member. My wife's a member. We, our staff are members. It is a great and easy way to get engaged with us and help us grow this movement. I'll end just with two final thoughts. So the first is this. The first is that I believe God can redeem anything and anyone. And maybe there's some people here who feel like, I don't know, your past or the mistakes of your past are defining your future. I would like to offer myself as living proof that you are not as bad as me, probably. I mean, like, you'll see in the book, it gets pretty grim. I mean, the depths of depravity that I sunk to are pretty unparalleled. But yet, stepping out in faith and obedience and walking away from that, I really got a do-over. I got a clean, clean slate. This guy is completely gone. You would not invite this guy to speak at church, okay? God's blessed me with an amazing life's mission, an amazing work. I get to travel around the world and preach a message of redemption and generosity and compassion and help people get clean water every day. He's blessed me with an amazing wife and two incredible kids. It's my wife, Victoria, my son, Jackson, and his daughter, Emma. This is my favorite verse in Joel is this. I will restore to you the years that the locusts have eaten. It lists all these nasty worms I'd never heard of. I had to look up Palmer worms and canker worms. What sounds grosser than a canker worm? Right, you get this picture of desolation, of barrenness. I Googled locust hordes. I got this image. Right, a place where nothing can grow. Maybe you feel like some of your lives are like that, where nothing good can grow. The next verse says, after God says, I will restore those years, says, you will have plenty to eat until you're full, and you will praise the name of the Lord, your God, who has worked wonders for you. And it's so true in my life. God has worked wonders for me in my life. I know he's worked wonders for so many of you, and he's waiting to for others, if you'll let him. I'll leave you with this quote. A friend sent this as he passed a bodega 10 years ago. It's from an old rabbinic text. Do not be afraid of work that has no end. Do not be afraid of work that has no end. And this is how we look at our work. If your work is a pursuit of ending the needless suffering you see around you, in your local community, in the global community, if your work is using your time and your talents, your money, what God has blessed you with, to serve others, it is a never-ending work. See, when we end the water crisis, we are not gonna just drop the mic and quit. We'll take everything we've learned, we'll take our community, we'll turn our attention on another pressing need, maybe hunger, maybe a justice issue, maybe shelter. It is a never-ending work, and I've come to embrace that. That used to scare me. And now I've come to embrace that. So I would call you to that work. Use what you have. The more you give, whether it's time, whether it's money, the more you give.
If you are encouraged by today's talk and believe it would be uplifting to others, then be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church podcast.